I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's June 23rd, and we have a lot to talk about. Over the past several weeks, the United States has been forced to revisit, re-examine, and reconsider its own history of racial inequality. This difficult but necessary national conversation has been driven by instances of racial injustice that have their origins in much broader systemic or institutional racism. Now, our conversations on Real Talk MS typically focus on multiple sclerosis research and multiple sclerosis care. So how does the subject of racial inequality find its way onto today's episode? Well, my guest today is Dr. Jackie Batrai, and Dr. Batrai's research is focused on identifying and understanding the causes of racial disparities in multiple sclerosis care. I think you'll find our conversation thought-provoking, maybe surprising, and I hope concerning. But before we get to my conversation with Dr. Jackie Batrai, there are a few other things that you should know about. I want to invite you to a global webcast that's going to take place this Thursday, June 25th, when I'll be getting together virtually with three world-class MS experts. Professor Alan Thompson, the chair of the Progressive MS Alliance Scientific Steering Committee and pro-vice provost and dean of the Faculty of Brain Sciences at University College London. Professor Maria Pia Sormani from the University of Genoa, a biostatistics expert in MS and a lead in Italy's national COVID-19 and MS study. And Dr. Timothy Cutsey, Chief Advocacy, Service and Research Officer at the National MS Society and a fellow member of the International Progressive MS Alliance Scientific Steering Committee. And our conversation is going to focus on speeding the development of life-changing treatments for progressive MS, and given current circumstances, we'll also be discussing COVID-19 and MS. We'll get into what we know about the experiences of people with MS who have contracted the virus, and we're going to talk about how people with progressive MS can be minimizing their risk. The webcast is being hosted by the International Progressive MS Alliance, which represents an unprecedented global collaboration aimed at developing better treatments for progressive MS until we solve progressive MS. The Alliance includes 19 MS organizations from countries around the world, hundreds of researchers and health professionals, the pharmaceutical industry, companies, foundations, donors, and people affected by progressive MS. In short, the Alliance has brought the world together to solve progressive MS. It's my honor to be a member of the Alliance Scientific Steering Committee, where I'm constantly humbled by the passion and relentless commitment that these scientists bring to the challenges of shortening clinical trials, identifying promising new research pathways, and developing life-changing treatments for people living with progressive MS. I'm looking forward to this Thursday's webcast, and I hope you're planning to join me. You'll find a link to the online registration page in today's show notes. Thanks to MRI technology, it's possible to get an MS diagnosis faster than ever before. But it's equally important to get an accurate diagnosis. And there's research that has shown that up to 20% of MS diagnoses prove to be inaccurate. So the National Institutes of Health has awarded the Cleveland Clinic a $7.2 million grant to study whether a proposed imaging biomarker called the central vein sign is a reliable diagnostic marker for MS. And as a quick review, a biomarker is a characteristic that can be objectively measured and evaluated as an indicator of normal or abnormal biological processes. For instance, if you go to your doctor because you're running a fever, your doctor might do a blood test. And if the results of that blood test indicate that your white cell count is high, your doctor will tell you that you have an infection. That elevated white cell count is a biomarker for infection. So the central vein sign refers to a vein visualized inside a white matter lesion on an MRI scan of the brain. The important characteristic of the central vein sign is that it can help differentiate MS from other conditions that may produce brain lesions, like meningitis, stroke, lupus, or Alzheimer's. A recent analysis of more than 4,000 brain lesions collected on MRI scans from 8 neuroimaging centers in Europe showed that detecting the central vein sign differentiated patients with MS from non-MS patients with otherwise similar brain lesions. So the Cleveland Clinic research team plans on enrolling 400 patients who are exhibiting MS symptoms in 11 different health centers across the United States. Identifying a reliable imaging biomarker for MS means more people are going to receive a more accurate diagnosis, which is going to lead to faster and better clinical decision-making. So we'll be following this work as it progresses. On last week's podcast, we spent some time talking about a few different studies that were focused on depression and MS. It's an important topic because we know that about half of everyone diagnosed with MS is likely going to be diagnosed with clinical depression. And in spite of that daunting reality, depression is still something that is often overlooked and therefore undertreated. If depression is something that's affecting you or a friend or family member who's living with MS, I hope you visit realtalkms.com/146 and give last week's episode a listen. Since last week, another study has provided one more important reason for clinicians to screen their MS patients for depression. In this study, a research team in the United States analyzed data from over 12,000 MS patients in both the United Kingdom and the United States. They compared the data from these patients with the data from over 100,000 people without MS, and they concluded that people living with MS are statistically 2 to 3 times more likely to develop depression compared to people without MS. So, if you needed one more reason to be sure that your neurologist is asking about depression, talking about your mood with you, and that doesn't just mean your mood on the day of your follow-up appointment, but your mood since your last appointment, and then referring you for treatment if necessary, well, I think you have that one more reason now. As I mentioned just last week, there may not be a cure for MS today, but today, depression is something that can be successfully treated. So please be sure you're not unnecessarily limiting your quality of life and you're taking care of your emotional wellness. If you'd like to check out the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. Research has provided evidence so that we know that smoking can make MS symptoms worse. We know that heat can make MS symptoms worse. And we know that depression can make MS symptoms worse. Well, research has also provided evidence that someone's neighborhood or income can affect the MS care that they receive. And some of that research has been conducted by my guest, Dr. Jackie Batrai. In a moment, we'll talk with Dr. Batrai about how the social determinants of health and other institutional factors impact the healthcare experience and the health outcomes of African Americans and members of other historically underserved populations who are living with MS. My guest is Dr. Jackie Batrai, a clinical psychologist and assistant professor of physical medicine and rehabilitation at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and a former National MS Society Multiple Sclerosis Research Fellow. I first met Dr. Batrai and became familiar with her research last November, which feels like about 1,000 years ago. And Dr. Batrai joined me on an episode of Real Talk MS this past March, but I'm glad we have the opportunity to reconnect today. Dr. Batrai's passion and her research are focused on studying racial disparities in multiple sclerosis care. For the past few weeks, the United States has been more focused on the subject of racial injustice than perhaps at any other time in our history, with the exception of the Civil War. And the subject of racial injustice covers a lot of ground, but when you talk about it, the conversation has to include the topic of disparities and inequities in the delivery of healthcare in America. And that's where Dr. Batrai's research comes in. Welcome back to the podcast, Dr. Batrai.
Hi, thank you, John. It is a delight to be back here speaking with you.
The world has really changed since the last time we talked, which wasn't that long ago. But as I said, I'm really glad we have the opportunity to talk today. And as I told you when we met, I think your research is incredibly important. And now it's an important part of the conversation about racial inequality that our country is having. I think a good place to start here is by defining a few terms. Can you help us understand what health inequities, social determinants of health, and maybe healthcare by zip code mean?
Yeah. So those are really important terms, and just to distinguish as well when we are having this conversation. So you mentioned, the first one you mentioned was health and inequities. And so oftentimes I've noticed people talk about health inequities and health inequalities interchangeably. However, these are two very distinct concepts. So the way I like to describe it is health inequalities are differences in health status or whatever it may be you're measuring. So the key there is the difference, the unequal aspect. Now, health inequities, or the opposite of that, health equity, is not just having differences in outcome or the same outcome. It is actually a little bit different. It's tailored to the context, the group that we are focusing on. So if we wanted to give true equality to all, we would give everyone the same kind of healthcare, the same exact maybe number of visits, let's say, to your MS provider, anything like that. However, given the history of the U.S., our country, and the disadvantages faced by certain groups, health equity would involve giving those disadvantaged groups a few more opportunities or a few more resources because they have not been given those historically and need those, compared to others at the top who may have all those resources and would not need help in that regard. And then you said the social determinants of health. So this goes right along this conversation about equity versus health inequity versus inequality. So social determinants of health involve all the things, the structural system in which one lives, works, and plays. And so it can include anything from, you know, like your healthcare quality, your transportation access, your neighborhood, level of violence in neighborhood, level of access to healthy food, all kinds of things. Because we know that healthcare is only one piece of what actually determines health status. All these other social determinants also play a big role. And as I was talking about, historically, some groups have been given the top-of-the-line resources that others have not been. And so this has allowed them to really overcome these barriers related to their social determinants, whereas others still encounter many problems in that regard. And so that's why they're called the determinants of health, because they determine really a lot of your health status. We are finding in research that want to do health disparities or health inequity work, we need to really consider things outside of the healthcare factor, including all these social determinants of health.
The way these social determinants of health might affect someone is if you happen to live in a neighborhood that is some distance away from, say, an MS center or a medical center, and and you don't happen to own a car, and you know you're going to need to take three different buses to get from home to an appointment, you might be less inclined to go to that appointment. And therefore, your health ends up suffering because of all these other factors. Am I getting that right?
Exactly, John. And in this context right now with the COVID-19 pandemic, it's even more relevant and important. Imagine, you know, when you're trying to weigh the pros and cons of, should I take these three different modes of public transportation and expose myself, right? I mean, that clearly would impact one's decision. And then you think about on the healthcare end, if you have a patient who no-shows, you don't know the situation, even no-shows or cancels the appointment as the provider, and their perceptions may change, right? Even though they may not even have a background on what's going on. So ultimately then it impacts lots of different things.
I can see that where the doctor on the other side, when you don't appear at that appointment, they may draw a conclusion that you're not as invested or interested in your own treatment course. And really it had nothing to do with that. It's you trying to avoid COVID-19 by not jumping on three different buses.
Exactly. So that's why I've seen movement in the healthcare space to really talk about like some of the major social determinants of health at especially new patient visits. But just kind of checking in on that with patients. I know at Hopkins we're implementing that with across all visits, and I hope to see that across all healthcare spaces.
Well, let's drill down to some specifics about MS care. Can you share some examples of health disparities that people living with MS can be faced with? And what are some of the factors that contribute to these kinds of disparities?
So the current disparities, I guess the most well-known established disparities involve those that are of neurologic nature. So neurologic being like physical disability, brain lesions, ability to ambulate, to walk independently, all those factors. So we know that among Black and Latin in the Hispanic group, that MS progresses far more rapidly, meaning disability progresses and comes much earlier. And with disability comes many other difficulties, including death, and which there's data that shows that Black people specifically can experience up to 10 years earlier mortality compared to their white counterparts in neurologic populations. So there's a lot of long downstream consequences that we may not be able to observe right away in like research, but down the road they have some really detrimental effects. So those are kind of the main neurologic disparities. More up and coming in the MS research that we need more of, a lot of what my work focuses on, is like other modifiable factors. So these neurologic disparities, they aren't seen, I guess, as modifiable as something like the patient-provider relationship or quality of healthcare. Those things are I would say maybe more behavioral too, in a sense that we can change those more readily than we can neurologic factors. Neurologic factors are more of like the outcome of some of these things. So that there's more research in the MS realm coming out about those modifiable factors, because those will actually present areas that we can target for intervention. We have to know kind of where this problem is originating before we can develop solutions to solve the problem. One piece of this that I wanted to bring up, the MS literature, there's a lot of research on genetics and how, you know, there's differences in genetics between maybe racial groups and whatnot. And, you know, I'm not a geneticist, so I can't speak to those aspects. However, what I do know is that over generations of this people having experience in privilege or disadvantage, our genes tend to, you know, evolve with time. And so I think that the genetics piece, it's really difficult. We have to navigate that carefully, especially given the history of that area of research. We have to navigate it carefully so as not to blame people or say, this is a genetic difference, but there's nothing that can be done about it. Because genetics, like I said, evolve over decades, over generations with our environment as well. So I think that's just an area that I've read a lot about. And just something to keep in mind. So I'm excited for this new group of research focuses that are coming about.
I know that your research looks at racial disparities in certain, as you put it, modifiable symptoms associated with MS. What made you want to explore this whole realm?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think, so there's two kind of big reasons. Is my background is in psychology. I'm a rehabilitation psychologist by training, that's what my degree's in, and so I really got interested, though, in grad school in chronic health conditions and specifically MS, which is slightly different than what I anticipated doing. But I realized that psychology just plays such a big role in this healthcare space. And psychology involves all these modifiable factors, like the relationship between the patient and the provider, which we know has a huge impact on the quality of healthcare and ultimately outcomes. So I think just a lot of like my professional interests, as well as observing firsthand in my personal life. I think the differential treatment that people near and dear to me, like, you know, my parents who are also immigrants like me, but have stronger accents. So the immigrant part of them is much more apparent, right, when they go to doctor's visits. And so seeing kind of this desperate treatment that they experience really made me want to look further into this. And I found that they are not the only ones with this experience. So, and these are the modifiable factors that I was seeing. And I saw in other research patient populations that these modifiable factors have been studied and have been modified. And so I thought we really need to do this in MS as well.
Well, the results of your research and other research that's been done, they really illustrate a sociological issue that has serious health implications for African Americans who are living with MS. How do we fix this?
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a big question, John, and how to fix this. So, you know, I could tell you some really key ingredients needed to reduce these inequalities and inequities, but ultimately, what this is going to require is a larger effort than, for example, simple interventional research carried out by a clinical researcher at your local institution. It's going to require lots of collaboration, interprofessional collaboration between not only like research institutes, but our healthcare centers, but also policymakers, transportation sector, finance sector, businesses. I mean, these inequalities in health that we see right now are not just the result of providers delivering unequal care by any means. It's a combination. It's a compounded effect of all the decisions that our society in the United States, the decisions that we've made, where we intentionally have given, well, intentionally or unintentionally, provided the best of our resources to certain groups and not to others. And now we're seeing what we're seeing. And so it really has to be a multi-sector effort at focusing on those that are most underserved and historically disadvantaged.
And
what so happened? Did that clarify the answer? Is that clear as mud? Easy.
It clarifies a very complex question. So I appreciate that answer. And I guess the flip side of that coin, I'll ask that as well. What happens if we don't address these systemic issues?
Well, there's many, many things that can happen. I think the one thing that is able to capture the attention of people across sectors, like I was talking about, including politicians and business, people in business, is that as the U.S., I mean, we spend the most money already in healthcare, yet some of, you know, our groups, especially those at the bottom, our groups and populations have as low quality of healthcare as some very under-resourced countries like Nepal, the one that my family and I came from, which is a shock to hear given how much money we spend. And so if we don't try to address these, we are going to continue wasting money, these funds, and we're not going to see anything in return. We might for the top group at the top, but not for everyone. And the way I see it is, you know, we as a group, as a whole, as a country, are only as strong as those at, you know, at the bottom. And so we have to take care of everyone in order to improve our health. And we have to make sure that our system, not only our healthcare system, but the entire system that's interconnected, works for everyone and not just certain groups of people. Because otherwise, again, the funds, the efforts are not working. I'm hoping that it's that lens that will continue to keep other sectors interested in this effort.
We know that multiple sclerosis doesn't play favorites when it attacks. And as a society, we can't afford to play favorites when it comes to delivering MS care. Dr. Jackie Batrai, thank you for the important work that you're doing. And thanks again for talking with me today.
Yeah, thank you so much, John. Thank you.
Well, that's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/147. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or text. I don't think I have to tell anyone listening to this podcast that the COVID-19 pandemic has intensified and in some cases multiplied the challenges of living with MS, from having difficulty affording MS medications, to adjusting to increased isolation, to coping with the added uncertainty of wondering how you or your family might be personally affected by COVID-19. More than ever before, people living with MS need access to reliable information, support, and connection. We're witnessing that even during a pandemic, MS doesn't stop, and neither does the National MS Society. So they've established the National MS Society COVID-19 Response Fund to ensure that the Society can continue meeting the urgent and expanding needs of the MS community during these unprecedented times. During the pandemic, we've seen the MS Society create virtual programming and support groups literally on the fly, so that no one has to face MS alone. They've created resources and provided information so that doctors and nurses can deliver the very best care. They've continued to amplify the voices of the MS movement to influence critical public policy decisions, and they've never stopped advancing research to find cures for MS. I know that these are financially tough times for a lot of people, but I'm asking that as you're able, please make a donation to support the National MS Society. To donate, you can text the word GIVE to 68686, and you'll get a link right to the MS Society's COVID-19 Response Fund webpage. Or if you prefer, I've created an online shortcut to get you to that same webpage, so you can visit realtalkms.com/COVID-19-response-fund. And COVID-19 Response Fund is all one word, and you can make your donation. You'll find that link in today's show notes, but however you choose to contribute, please contribute today. It's never been more important. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.